Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Today, we have a fantastic guest. I'm really excited. She is, this is the second time she's been on our show, and really grateful for both time for her being here. Yasmin Mohammed, ladies and gentlemen, she is a Canadian author and a human rights activist advocating for the rights of women living within Islamic majority countries, as well as those who struggle under religious fundamentalism. She's the founder of Free Hearts, Free Minds, an organization that provides psychological support for free thinkers living within Muslim-majority countries, where the state-sanctioned punishment for leaving Islam is death. Additionally, she is the author of the book Unveiled, How Western Liberals Empower Radical Islam. Yasmin, welcome, and so glad you're here today.
Thank you so much, Eric. I'm so glad to be here, too.
So we're here to talk about your foundation, Free Hearts and Free Minds. First off, why isn't there a comma in there? No, but tell us, what is Free Hearts, Free Minds? What's the whole mission? Why are you here this evening?
Well, Free Hearts, Free Minds. So the Free Hearts part of it refers to any folks from the LGBT community, Free Hearts. So unfortunately, in about a dozen countries across the world, it is punishable by execution to be part of the LGBT community. Of course, it's criminalized in over 70 countries. So that's still a really big issue that needs to be addressed. So that's the Free Hearts part. And the Free Minds part is referring to free thinkers, specifically in the Muslim majority world, people who have denounce the religion of Islam and again are living in countries that could execute them for that crime. And quite often we have people that fulfill both the free hearts and the free minds, you know, so they're a double at risk. So what we do is we provide psychosocial support to help those people in the situations that they're in, which are usually it's crisis intervention, yeah. It's trauma, it's a lot of suicidal ideations, things like that. So by the time people contact us, they are usually at a very difficult place in their life. And I should mention that, mental health support is not very popular in the Muslim majority world anyway, just as far as like a cultural thing, because there's more, these are very religious countries and there's a lot of leaning on just pray, pray it away, ask Allah to, cure your depression or your gayness, you know what I mean? So they just, this is how they deal with things. So it's quite a paradigm shift. It's difficult sometimes for people to reach out and ask for help because they feel like asking for mental health support means that they're crazy. Mm. And so there's a stigma there.
Like only crazy people get, they're the ones who need the therapist or the psychotherapist.
Yes. The ones who don't believe in imaginary friends are the crazy ones. So, yeah.
Well, Yasmin, I can tell that this is a big passion of yours. How do you feel about kind of sharing your own story and why this became a passion for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in Canada, so secular, free country, but I grew up under a little bubble of Sharia, so under what is now being called separatist societies. So if you think of maybe the community of Hasidic Jewish people in New York who are kind of, you're living in New York, but you're living separate from everybody else. You speak a different language, you go to different schools. So you're living in like a parallel to the rest of the society, but you're not living integrated with them. So that's how I grew up. I went to Islamic schools. I was put in hijab at 9 years old. I was forced into a marriage at 19. I lived a very, you know, the people that I relate to the most are women in Saudi Arabia. We feel like we've, obviously it's not the same, because for me, I could get out of my current family situation and then I was in a free country. Whereas for them, they have many more obstacles. But when it comes to how we were brought up, the kinds of things that we were indoctrinated with, it was all very similar. So growing up in Canada in a very fundamentalist household, I was that kid who probably a lot of people here are going to relate to. I was that kid who was always asking questions. I was that one kid. Yeah, it's usually us. We're that one that gets kicked out of class for, you know, asking, you know, if Adam had a belly button or something.
It's a legitimate question.
Yeah. Let's delve into that, Kara.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up.
So, I was always getting in trouble for asking the most basic questions. I remember being horrified when I found out that, I always knew that Aisha was 9. That's one of the Prophet Muhammad's wives. I always knew she was 9, but it didn't really dawn on me until I started to get older. You know what I mean? Like when you're 5 or 6 years old, 9 feels like, oh, that's like ancient. And then when I started to get closer to 9 years old, and then I realized that he was 53, and I was starting to have more of an understanding of ages and age gaps. And then I was like, whoa, hold on a minute. So I got in a lot of trouble for questioning that, because of course he's chosen by Allah to be the best of humanity. So who am I to question something like that? But it's really scary as a girl to be constantly being told that you must accept things that make your heart and mind uncomfortable. And so that was how I grew up. I was constantly being told, you know, you are lesser than a man. You must cover yourself in this clothing so that you don't entice men, so that you don't cause chaos in the land. You don't cause fitna and encourage a man to rape you, and then he will have sinned and that's your fault. And so there's just a lot of, I'm sure there's, if people grew up here in fundamentalist Christian households, they're going to relate to that as well, that feeling of just being ashamed of who you are and of your body, and feeling like you carry all of this, in a sense, power of causing corruption in the world. So I grew up this way, and it wasn't until, so like I mentioned, I was forced into a marriage at 19. The man who I was forced to marry was a member of Al-Qaeda. He'd been in Afghanistan with bin Laden for, you know, over a decade before he came to Canada. And my family chose him because they felt like he was strong enough to control me, because this was the second time they tried to force me into a marriage.
Wow.
Yeah. The first time was with my cousin, and I was able to get myself out of it. And so they felt, well, we need somebody who is going to really be able to control this girl. So that's why they chose him. And it worked.
This was in Al-Qaeda in Canada.
Yes.
British Columbia?
Absolutely. Yes. In Vancouver. So Eric, he entered the country. So he is Egyptian. He entered the country from Afghanistan with a fake Saudi Arabian passport. Like there were so many red flags.
Oh, gosh.
And then he was given refugee status. So he was a refugee here.
That's just kind of like, yes, this is a horrible situation, but to me, they had to find somebody because you were just so strong. Yeah. And would not take much shit, it sounds like. And it's still a horrible situation, but it kind of speaks to your incredible personality.
Yeah, well, you know, unfortunately it worked. So he completely, he succeeded in depleting me completely. I was, he was physically abusive. Marital rape in Islam is normalized. because you are told that you are his property and you are not allowed to say no to him. And same thing with being beaten by him. Again, this is sanctioned in the Quran. So my mom, being the head of the Islamic Studies Department at the Islamic School, you know, she's a student of Al-Azhar University, which is the most prestigious Islamic university on the planet. And so it was very important that I understand the source of why I have to accept these things. Because I was the kind of, I would fight and push until she'd show me the ayah or show me the hadith. And then I had nothing. What more could I fight? This is the edict straight from Allah, you know, the literal word of Allah. So there, at that point, that's when you submit, which is the definition of the word Islam. So I submitted. He was, you know, as horrible as you would expect a marriage to be, married to a terrorist. And I had a daughter with him. And that's when everything changed, because even though I was unhappy following all of these edicts, I followed them all because I was scared. I was scared of burning in hell for eternity. But there's always sort of this little hope at the back of your mind that's like, well, one day I might get out. One day I might be free. And when I held my little daughter in my arms, and if any of you are parents, you know that feeling of just absolute protection. You just really want to protect this child. You want them to have the happiest life. And then it dawned on me that I was going to have to put that light out for myself and put the light out for her, that she would never see freedom. She would never know freedom. And it would be even worse than it was for me, because he was talking about taking her to Egypt to get her, you know, female genital mutilation. So to get her, I guess the euphemism for that is female circumcision, but it's a lot more than that. They take a razor and they slice off her clitoris. So he was talking about doing that. He was talking about moving to Peshawar and living with Al-Qaeda there. And so I knew I had to find strength from somewhere. At this point, I have a high school education, no support whatsoever. I've been completely separated from any friends that I'd had, because that's the first thing an abuser does, is they make sure that you don't have anyone to lean on. And these were the days before Facebook or anything. So there was no way of contacting any friends that you'd had before. And so I felt very alone in the world, but I knew I had to somehow get my daughter out. I wasn't quick enough to get her out. And then I got pregnant a second time. And that's when I was so angry at myself that I had hesitated. I was so angry that I didn't just run out the door. And then it turned out that that baby didn't have a heartbeat. And so when I was in the clinic getting DNC surgery, the nurse said to me, "You're going to be groggy because you're going under general anesthetic. So you're going to need somebody to help you with your little daughter. And so you're just going to need someone for about 24 hours or so." So I told him I would need help for a week, because I knew that he would never be willing to help me for a week. So I said, "I have to go stay with my mom for a week to recover from this surgery." And I knew that getting away from my mom would be easier than getting away from him. So that was my only plan at that point, was get out of his house, go to my mom's, and then figure it out from there. And so when I went to my mom's the next day, she got up to go to work. Like I said, she was the head of the Islamic Studies Department at the Islamic School. And I picked up the yellow pages and I found a lawyer and I asked her for full custody, a restraining order, and a divorce. And Wow. Yeah, she was amazing. Wow. I'm still in contact with her.
Oh, that's so
She's
good.
Like, if there were angels, she is one of them. Like, she did everything. No cell phone, so we couldn't stay in contact. I could just give her, you know, my mom's number, but then say, "Don't ever call this number, but this is where I'll be." Because of course my mom wouldn't want me to divorce him either, because that's a shame on the family, a dishonor, a divorced daughter, yada, yada. So long story short, this is all detailed in my book, yeah. Very long, but eventually I was able to get myself and my daughter out and start going to university, which I never in a million years imagined I'd ever be able to do. And when I was in university, I took a history of religions course. And while I was in that history of religions course, 9/11 happened. So it was just, I was bombarded both emotionally from 9/11 and intellectually from this course. And it just unraveled, you know, like a house of cards. And again, as many people in this talk here will probably be able to relate to, even though you cognitively understood that, or you cognitively don't believe in this stuff anymore, you still have like, that in your body, the indoctrinated fears are still there. So even though I don't believe in Allah, I'm still like fearing him. It was a very, you know, I'm sure yeah. anybody who has been brainwashed yes. will understand. It's yeah, so hard to describe, absolutely. Right?
No, yeah. I completely understand. I had the same, and so many people in my family as well, or, you know, that I know have said exactly the same thing. I don't believe it anymore, but I still feel like a knot, you know, in my stomach if I say it yeah. out loud.
And modesty was a big thing too. Like all of the modesty culture stuff, the purity culture. Yeah. I can see Glenda's getting it. Yes. It takes yeah. so long, you know, even though you yeah. know all of this stuff, this is rape culture. This is horrible. This is slut shaming. This is victim blaming, but still you're feeling insecure if your shorts are too short, you know, like you're yeah. just, so
there's
anyway.
A big gap between intellectually understanding something and emotionally, like they rarely can come together.
Yeah.
And we can intellectually understand like, oh yeah, the hell doesn't exist, but emotionally still be petrified of it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, and to just get used to doing those things and, you know, seeing yourself in that way. And, you know, it's just something you haven't done for your whole life. And of mm-hmm. course, that would take a lot of getting used to. Mm-hmm. I'm curious as well. It sounds like you got out of this situation very cleverly. I mean, without, you know, really having a lot of time to plan. Were you aware that you would be able to get out and, you know, have these resources like the legal representation, the being able to go to the university? Did you think that would happen?
I mean, that's a really good question. And the answer is a big, huge, resounding no. I had no idea. I didn't even know there was such thing as women's shelters. So I grew up in I was very, very isolated from the rest of the world around me. I didn't know what Canadian culture was like. I didn't know when I wanted to rent a place and when I wanted to like, you know, start riding the bus to go to university or applying for student loans or I had no idea how to do anything. So I had to, yeah. So it was so much more difficult in the days before Google.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know how to be a mom either. I was 20. And so I was just, you know, I didn't know anything. And being 20 or 21 as a Muslim girl who's raised in such a, you know, you're in such a closed community, it's more like being 14 or 15, I'd say, for your average Canadian. Like it's, you're so infantilized all the time. You are constantly, you are never to see yourself as an independent, autonomous human being. You are always a dependent, you are a piece of, you know, like you belong to something. You're there to your, for your family's honor or your husband's honor, or, you know what I mean? You're always an extension of somebody. You're never autonomous. Mm. And so that was a huge mind shift.
Oh yeah.
About a year ago, we had a guest on RFRX, Ido Uwini. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm missaying her last name. And she had a similar, you know, wasn't quite exactly, but similar experience. And her uncle blinded her, and she told this story. Were you at all afraid, or did you have to run away from these honor killings or honor disfigurements? Was that something that you were, that was in the back of your mind that you had to be afraid of?
It was in the forefront of my mind, Eric. honor violence, honor killings are constantly front and center. So, I had a talk with Ion Hercieli, who I hope most of you know. If you don't, then please get to know her. She's an amazing woman. And in it, we were talking about how common the phrase, "I'll just bury you in the backyard," was.
What? Is.
Wow.
Yeah.
So is this for, like a saying?
It's a saying. So, I mean, she was telling me that she has spoken with law enforcement in Dearborn, Michigan, who were telling her, we know that there are bodies in all these backyards, but the amount of, like, you know, just like the manpower that it would take to figure out all, to solve all of these crimes. And then you are dealing with a whole community that wants to hide the crime and that is going to support the criminals. And I mean, it's just this, it's this huge monstrous thing. Like, I will recommend for everyone to watch a documentary, which is on YouTube. It's called Benaz, A Love Story. And it's the story of a woman named Benaz in the UK who went to the police on 5 different occasions saying, my family is trying to kill me. My father is trying to kill me. And they didn't take her seriously because she's just a young woman. And she's being hyperbolic, you know, she's just exaggerating. Oh, my dad's trying to kill me. But no, she's from Iraq. She's a Kurdish Iraqi. And law enforcement are not quite aware yet of how prevalent honor violence is and honor killings are. And they made a ITV miniseries about her story, and that's called Honor. And that miniseries follows the detective who found Benaz buried in the backyard of her family's home. And she was unwilling to let it go. And so she chased the men who murdered Benaz all the way back to Iraq, which doesn't commonly happen. So, you know, very recently there was a girl in Italy, a 17-year-old girl who was forced to marry a cousin of hers in Pakistan, and she refused. And she went to the authorities saying, please help me. But then again, as you might be familiar with abusive relationships, it's never really that easy to just walk away. So even though she went to authorities asking for help, her family said, you know, that's okay. We forgive you. Come back. And so she did. And the last footage they have is of her, the CC, like the cameras from the building of her family walking with shovels. And the girl has disappeared and her family have gone back to Pakistan. And that's usually how the story ends. So for this one detective who chased the men back to Iraq is not common. But of course, she's an amazing woman. She wrote a book about her, about the whole story as well. But unfortunately, yes, that's something that would, I was commonly told, everybody was commonly told, people did disappear. And in Canada, we had honor killings. It was not unheard of. It wasn't the kind of thing that only happens over there. It happens over here, and we knew it happened over here. We had a 16-year-old girl named Aksa Parvez who was strangled to death by her father and her brother because she refused to wear a hijab. The stories are endless, endless, endless stories. And again, back in the day, before social media or anything like that, it was really easy. And this is what my mom would tell me. It's really easy to just bury you in the backyard and say, she's moved to Egypt. She got married in Egypt. Wow. That's it. Done.
Wow.
And going to an Islamic school, that happened. You come back after summer holidays and, you know, where's your friend? They got her married off in Pakistan. Did they though? Did they? And even if they did, I mean, it's still a horrible fate. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know which one is worse, to be honest. But
So next kind of question is, what prompted the formation of this foundation?
I didn't even get to answer that.
sounds like it perfectly makes perfect sense. I can feel your passion. If I was in your situation and came out on the other end, I wouldn't want people to go through this. I'd want to help people as much as I could. But is your story fairly common with folks in these Islamic nations or Islamic bubbles?
And yes, Islamic bubbles in Western nations as well. Yeah. So that's exactly what happened. So I was quiet for about 10 years, totally petrified of he's Al-Qaeda. I don't know where his friends are. I don't know how connected he is. So my daughter and I both changed our names. We both moved out of the country. We're both like scared to death. Well, she's not scared to death. I'm scared to death for her. And I stayed quiet, got remarried, had another little daughter, living my life. And then the infamous episode of Bill Maher, where Sam Harris and Ben Affleck were the guests. Bill Maher and Sam Harris were talking about people who have denounced Islam in Egypt, or about 90% of Egyptians feel that they should be executed. Because Egypt is one of the countries that does not execute you for leaving Islam. What they do instead is they put you in a psychiatric ward. So I was kidding in the beginning, but that's actually what happens in Egypt. And I've spoken to people who have been put by their families in psychiatric wards, horrific things happening to them, stuff from horror movies, because they don't believe in Allah. So there's something wrong with you. So Bill Maher and Sam Harris are talking about this. And it was this really weird moment where I felt like these men were advocating for me when I had never even advocated for myself. You know, I was silent, I was quiet, I was scared. And here they are on HBO talking about me, basically me, because I'd left Islam and my family is from Egypt. And so they were speaking of course, you know, hundreds of thousands of other people, but I felt like I was being seen and heard for the first time in a way that I hadn't even seen or heard myself. And so I was inspired to write my book, and where I wanted to share my story, because of course the next day on Facebook, all my friends are like, yay, Ben Affleck shut down the gross and racist guys. Oh, those white American men, what do they have? You know, they're just a bunch of, you know, whatever, this and that. And I was just like, oh man, like, did you guys even hear what these men were saying? They didn't even hear what they were saying. They did not engage. Yeah. Thank you, Jeff. I agree. So he just jumped in and he silenced the conversation. So here I am feeling all excited and, you know, seen and heard and validated. And then he comes along and he just shuts down the whole conversation. And
Sam Harris and Bill Maher were talking about how awful Islam was. And Ben Affleck
about how, as liberals who support liberal values, we need to support liberal values universally. So if we're going to stand up for freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, freedom of thought in the Western world, then we cannot ignore free thinkers in the rest of the world as well. And they're giving many examples. They also talked about LGBT. They said, you know, if we're going to support it so much here, we're going to talk about it. We've evolved so much from the 80s. So we have to also talk about it in countries where those communities are even bigger risk than they are in America. That was their argument, is that we have to be universal in our values. We cannot just keep them within this geographic location. And so after the next day on Facebook, when everybody was complimenting Ben Affleck, I felt like, oh man, I need to speak up. Like, I'd been quiet for 10 years, but now I have to speak up. I have to give my perspective. I have to give my side of the story. But I was too scared to do that.
Well, that's pretty understandable. I'm yes. going to say I probably yeah. wouldn't have written that book if it was me.
Yeah. Yeah, I was too scared to do that. And I'll tell you why I wrote it, Kara, and it's related to why I started this organization. So when I started to write it, I was writing it anonymously and I was posting it on Tumblr, if anybody remembers Tumblr.
Oh, yes.
And I was just inundated with messages from people who were relating to my story. And I'm like, this is like from chapter one. I hadn't even really gotten into anything yet. And they were just from everywhere in the world, you know, places I'd never even spoken to somebody from Mauritania before. And now here's some woman from Mauritania telling me reading this chapter felt like I was reading my own words, you know, and it was just, I realized that there were so many of us, we all have this shared experience, these shared traumas. But I'm privileged in that I'm living in a safe Western country where I can write about this. Whereas the people that I'm speaking to are in countries that people have been hacked to death in the streets with machetes in Bangladesh for speaking about liberal values. Raif Badawi in Saudi Arabia has been, you know, whipped in the streets. You know what I mean? These are not countries where you can speak freely. And so I was sort of shamed. Well, I was shamed into not being anonymous anymore. And then I started to do interviews with my face. And then more and more people started to feel that they could trust me, because here I am saying the things that they would never be able to say, saying things that they'd never heard anybody else say before. And so they knew they could trust me with their stories. And that's when it all erupted, because I was already raw, because I'm in the middle of writing my story, things I forced myself not to think about for a decade. It's all out there in the open. I'm writing it down. I'm thinking about it to the extent that I have to recount it. So I have to go into detail about how did I feel? You know, what did they say? And so I'm in this raw, fragile state, and I'm getting inundated with messages from people telling me their traumas, their situations, which makes my story feel like a fairy tale compared to the stories that I'm hearing.
That's difficult to imagine. That's yeah. incredible.
Yeah. Oof. And wow. So that's when I, to be perfectly honest, I became suicidal. I became agoraphobic. I had to take a year off work. I was just an absolute mess. It was, it was a really bad time. And that's when I realized I can't do this. And what's helping me is therapy. Mm-hmm. And so what I need are professionals. But of course, the only reason why people are contacting me is because they feel safe contacting me. So I had to play the part of this, you know, the person in the middle and say, okay, contact me, and then I will pass you on to a trusted therapist. And so that's how Free Hearts, Free Minds came to be, is because I needed to make sure that the people that I was connecting them with were people that I trusted, and that they were people that I knew understood their situations, and that they were safe, because it's very, very important. Ex-Muslims are scared. They're petrified of sharing even their first name. Like they'll give a fake first name. They'll have their, it's very, very dangerous to share how you think or how you feel or who you are. I mean, we have a recent client who, you know, she met a guy online and met up with him, and he turned out to be an undercover police officer.
Oh,
yeah, that was in Saudi Arabia. So that's the kind of things that they pull.
Sounds like these Muslim majority countries are using some Soviet tactics, some 1984 tactics to get in, to root out the people who aren't following in line. And it also sounds like, for example, your neighbors or your family are encouraged to report, then, because if they don't, they're going to get hurt too. It sounds like that's kind of what's going on in these many of these Muslim majority countries.
Absolutely true. So not only is it a police state, so they're afraid for their own skin, so they're going to tell on their family member, because just in case it comes out that they knew and they didn't say anything, they're going to be in trouble. So all of that's true. And then also on, you know, judgment day and hereafter for the rest of eternity, you're going to be suffering because you must love Allah and His Messenger more than your own family. So you have to, your loyalty has to be in the right place. It really is a cult mentality. So again, people in this group who grew up in any kind of fundamentalist religion will understand that cult, us and them mentality. And it's very, very, what's the word that I'm looking for?
Like they get you to police yourself. Basically.
They get you to police yourself. And also their love conditional. That's the word. I don't just pop it in my head. It's very, very conditional love. Yes. So your family will only love you as far as you are following the rules. You have to be part of the group. I've seen this in like Scientology documentaries when they talk about leaving, like easily, they'll just like cut off ties with their father or their sister or their brother or, you know, their kids even. It's easy to do because your connection with your family is subordinate to your connection with your cult leader or whatever.
And that's such an interesting point that you make too, that, you know, if it's at the family level, you know, this isn't even just a conversation about something that's happening in Muslim majority countries. Like your experience happened here in North America. I mean, this could be anywhere. Have you noticed, you know, with your client base, I mean, is you have people from all over? I mean,
all over.
Are there others in your situation as well, right?
Yes, we do have people from all over all the time. And they really, that's part of like, part of the reason why we have therapists that we work with who are, you know, they have their own private practices. So if I get a message from somebody in Sweden, I'll say, well, I can't help you at Free Hearts, Free Minds because we support people in Muslim majority countries. However, I can recommend that you contact this person who understands your, you know, background, understands your predicament, understands your culture, and is willing to support you. So we do work with a lot of therapists who have their own private practices for different situations. Sometimes it's because somebody needs more help than we're able to provide. So, you know, if it's somebody who has got bipolar disorder or something like that, that we are not, it's so difficult to do that kind of work via Zoom. And then of course there's like medications involved too. And sometimes quite often we get Muslim people contacting us. That's very common as well, because there's nobody in their family or in their friends groups they can communicate with. They don't feel safe. But they're in this space where they are doubting their religion and they're angry about a lot of the misogyny and stuff like that. But at the same time, their feelings are going to get hurt if somebody says, fuck Muhammad. So it's not a good fit either. So they also, we recommend private therapists for them. So there are some instances where we rely on therapists with their private practices.
Wow. It sounds like Free Hearts, Free Minds is really here to connect the people in Muslim majority countries who are struggling with both mental health issues and just need some regular counseling and therapy, to connect those with the people who can do that. And how many people do you, like, you have like a list of these people, or is it, and if so, how many people do you guys help every month or every year on a regular basis?
Well, not nearly as many as we would like to. So we're limited, of course, by our funds. And so we have a very long waiting list, which is, it's probably got one person from each of the 50 Muslim majority countries. It looks like the UN. We get a lot of people from Saudi Arabia and Egypt. So those seem to be our two top countries.
So we're talking on your list of folks who need help that aren't getting able to get help at the moment, like in the realm of 60, 75, close, getting up to 100, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And you just said there's 50 Muslim majority countries. I had no idea.
Yeah. It's the second largest religion on the planet. So people always talk about Islam as if it's a minority group. That's not true for Muslims. That's true for Jewish people. They're only like 2% of the planet or something. But that's not true for Muslims. So, that's important to note. They are very powerful politically because of those numbers and because of all of those Muslim majority countries. And so that's what makes it really scary to speak out, because there are a lot of people that are going to be pushing back against you.
I remember being a fanatic religious person as a kid, and if I felt like it would be in my religious community's best interest or it would make God happy, then I would, back in the day, I would have loved to have taken up the mantle of finding out these apostates and rooting them out and doing what I could. Like, I hate to admit that, but that would have been really attractive for me in that mindset back then. And I can imagine I'm not the only one who would feel that way. In that mindset.
No, and thank you for that honesty. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people that are in that mindset still, and who feel like it is their duty to please Allah and to get heaven, you know, and to, so rooting out the evils of people like me who have chosen to leave the religion. We never chose to be Muslims.
Yeah.
we were never asked, you know. I was born into a family that told me, you are Muslim. This is how you have to think, this is how you have to feel, this is how you have to be. So it's not even that we changed our minds, it's just that we used our minds for the first time and said, I don't want to be a part of this group. And the punishment for that is execution. You're given 3 days to repent. And if you don't repent within those 3 days, then you are to be executed. So there's certain arguments that happen within the Islamic community, because people like to say, well, it's different interpretations. The only interpretation is how we will be killed. That's where the arguments happen. Yeah. The argument.
That's quite the distinction.
Yeah. And I mean, that's similar to like what's happening in Afghanistan today is like it's so gross to talk about these things. The arguments that they're having right now is, how should we kill gay people? Should we burn them alive? Should we throw them off the top of a building? Should we stone them to death? Like, these are the discussions that they're having with their new government, trying to figure out what's going to be our new policies in our new country. There are a lot of people that want to do that. And that's Ayan Hirsi Ali, who I mentioned earlier in the podcast, is somebody who did a short movie with Theo van Gogh, who's the grandson of Vincent van Gogh, in Holland. It was like a short, like 15 minutes, where it's called Submission. She talked about how Islam treats women. It was very artistic. And Theo van Gogh, who was the director, was shot in the street of Holland. And Theo's last words to him were, can we talk about this? And no, you can't talk with people like that. And then stabbed in Theo's chest was a long diatribe, like the long note of against Ayan and how he's going to kill Ayan and how she's next. And so, of course, she has been She's under security all the time. She's got two children. You know, it's a dangerous world to be public about these things. And of course, most of you might be familiar with Salman Rushdie and what happened there. Mm-hmm. Again, the man wrote a novel. Like, it's not even just like the tiniest little bit of criticism. You're all familiar with Charlie Hebdo, mm-hmm. Drawing a cartoon, what can happen to you? Yeah. So the more we are silenced, the more terrorism works. And of course, people in all of the countries that we're helping in these 50 Muslim majority countries, they must be silent. They have to. They have. There's no question. They should be silent because it's incredibly unsafe. But for people like me who are living in the Western world, it comes with dangers, of course. But it is not the same as what you were describing before, Eric, of having your whole family and your neighbors and your coworkers and everybody around you would want you dead. So, so I'm in a position where I'm compelled to do this work and support them as much as I can.
Well, that still seems incredibly brave to me. Yeah. I mean, just from what you've described, that's really incredible. So I think you should give yourself a little more credit here.
Thanks, Kara.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't sound like the organization helps people escape from the situation or helps people move out of the country. I'm not hearing any of that. I'm really hearing this is more about the mental health and mental support.
So we don't do that directly. However, we do partner with groups that do. So for the Free Hearts part, we partner with Rainbow Railroad, which is a nod beautiful. To the Underground Railroad. Yeah.
Wow.
So Rainbow Railroad, they help, 75 people per year or something. Like they do great work. And they've got two ways of doing it. They've got the emergency way of just getting people out as soon as possible. And then they've also got with helping people through immigration, which can take, sometimes up to 2 years. So they're a really great organization and they help with the Free Hearts part. And then the Free Minds part, we're partnering with an organization called Secular Underground Network. And so there are some people that do want to escape, of course, that do need to escape, and those organizations help them do that. I really do feel that sometimes you have to get some psychosocial support and get yourself strong before you escape, because escaping is not as easy as that. Like you're leaving everything you've ever known and loved, even though it's been horrible to you, it's familiar, and you're moving to an entirely different planet, it feels like. And so it's very isolating and it's very difficult, and you have to be mentally strong to take that journey. So we partner with these groups where we offer them that mental health support, to offer them those tools to keep themselves, as strong as possible. And then these organizations help them to physically escape.
That kind of transitions us to a little bit of a positive, hopefully. Tell us some one or two success stories that has come out of the foundation, the Free Hearts, Free Minds work.
We have obviously a lot of stories, thankfully.
Yeah. You may not be able to say people's individuals' names for obvious reasons, but.
Yeah. If you go to our website and click on testimonials, you'll find many, many stories there from people telling their experiences and how Free Hearts, Free Minds has helped them. Julia Sweeney has this great TED Talk. She's on the CFI board of directors, and she's connected with one of our clients for Bangladesh, and she's going to write a book about his story because she was like just absolutely could not believe how difficult and intricate it was for him to just say, I don't believe in this religion anymore, because it's something that she went through and it's something that she knows so many people that have been through, and she just couldn't believe how difficult it was for him. And of course, because a lot of my advocacy is for women, because women under Islamic tyranny have it so much worse than men. So when she told me about this, my first comment to her was, let me get you in touch with some women and you can hear their stories. And, you know, if that's going to turn your hair gray, like it's just, it's not easy for anybody. It's all just on a spectrum. Of course, again, with the, if you identify as LGBT in any way on that whole spectrum, you're, oh man, like it's just, it's absolutely unfathomable how much more difficult your life becomes because of the way that you were born, because of the way Allah supposedly created you. You get punished for that, you know, from being a child sometimes, you know, as soon as your family start to feel that you're not fitting into the specific gender norms that they find to be acceptable.
There's a lot more testimonials on there on the website too. And I'm kind of looking at it right now. It's pretty darn inspiring and I'm really grateful for the work that Free Hearts, Free Minds does. Do you have any projects that you're kind of in the, that are kind of in the works at the moment? Like what are some, what is the future kind of look like for Free Hearts, Free Minds?
Well, right now we are transitioning into group sessions because we're trying to help more people in less time. And it also creates a community. And so what that means is that we're going to need a lot more one-on-one counselors, a lot more one-on-one therapists, because group work doesn't, you know, group sessions doesn't work for everybody. And right now we've been doing one-on-one. And so everybody's been able to get the full support that they need. But so our new project right now is figuring out how we're going to transition into group sessions, which we're very actively in the middle of right now. And I'm very proud of the sessions that we're coming up with. They are looking really great and I can't wait to get this started. But I'm also really nervous about having enough therapists who are willing to support our clients. Now we have a little trouble doing that for two reasons. Number one, very depressingly because of COVID. And so therapists are just inundated with clients because this is a very difficult time for everybody. And so it's hard for them to find time in their schedule to do, you know, more work. And the second reason why, well, there's three reasons actually. And the second reason why is because there are so many cultural components. There's so much to understand, that some people feel that it's too heavy. It's too difficult. There's too much that they would have to learn before they would be able to support our clients. And the third one is fear. I've spoken with so many therapists in the Arab world, in Israel, you know, who understand the culture, but are not geographically in a position where they would feel comfortable supporting us because, you know, of where they are. So
on your second point, what I'm hearing you say is that working as a therapist for, like, as a Western mental health professional, working with a client in a Muslim majority country is not at all like it would be working with a Western country client. Like, it's completely, what I hear you saying is that there's a lot of added baggage, a lot of added cultural nuances that therapists in the Western world just have no idea about and aren't nearly have the training for. Is that right?
I don't know if it's that they have no idea, no training, but I think it's that they probably feel like they want to be more confident in doing the work. Like they want to make sure that they understand the nuances. So let me give you an example. We had one therapist working with us who was feeling like she took it personally. She was feeling uncomfortable that the person that she was working with was unwilling to share. Really, she was having a difficult time sharing the most mundane information about herself. And I was trying to explain to her, like, don't take this personally. It has nothing to do with you. It's just that she lives in a police state. She lives in a place where she's always on edge. She's always nervous about sharing any personal, private information. Even giving her name is something that would make her cause so much anxiety for her. So it's just that there's so many things that they're unaware of. And I think that if they want to feel confident in supporting their clients, they want to know that, you know, that they want to know that they feel confident doing that. That's the feedback that I've gotten is like, there's a lot of things there. There's a lot of nuances that I need to understand more before I can feel more confident doing this work. So.
And so it sounds like the biggest, you know, of course the foundation needs money and folks can definitely go and donate. I assume through a website, your website or Patreon. But
or PayPal.
Okay, great. But you also, the foundation also needs therapists who are willing to take on these challenges. What kind of therapist would you feel like would be great for this kind of work?
Therapists that are interested in working with crisis intervention and also sexual therapists as well, because we have a lot of, as you can imagine, we have a lot, you know, I'm learning now too, because I'm just a boring old straight person. So I'm getting messages from somebody who's like a demi girl. And I'm like, oh, that's a, I'm going to look that one up. You know what I mean? So we need therapists who are understanding of the, I guess the specific needs and traumas of somebody who is having to hide their identity. I mean, it's a, from their, everybody around them and the self-hate that comes with that and all of those issues. So
sounds like such a tangled, it feels like in Christmas Vacation when Chevy Chase hands his ball of Christmas lights. Okay, now untangle it. It just sounds so tangled and I could see if I had something like that, it would take a lot of trust for me to be able to even speak and come forward with a stranger with a first session or even a second session.
Yeah. People and use fake names when they tell me their stories all the time. And then they'll like 2 years later, they'll send me an email and be like, actually, my name is really this, you know?
I think that we've kind of covered the whole breadth and scope of it. Is there anything that you feel that we've missed and that we need to discuss further that you want to bring up?
No, I think this was really great. I think that what's really important for people to recognize, which I think is sometimes not highlighted, is that, I guess if we go back to the questions, the reason why I wanted to ask those questions is because whenever I speak to somebody who grew up Jehovah's Witness or Mormon or, you know, Orthodox Jewish, we have so many similarities. Like we have so many internal struggles that we have to overcome. It may externally look different. So you all might be familiar with Alice Gretchen, who mm-hmm. wrote a really good memoir about her experience leaving fundamentalist Christianity, evangelical Christianity. And, you know, the way we described it when we were talking to each other is like, I wore niqab, which is covered head to toe in black. You couldn't see anything but my eyes. She wore a purity ring. It's much smaller and it's not quite as, you know, visually shocking, but it stems from the exact same place. So the overcoming that we've had to, you know, the work that we've had to do is very, very similar. And of course the same with our friend Fermet, who grew up Hasidic Jewish and had to shave her head. And the rabbi would come to her house to make sure that her head has been shaved, to make sure her hair isn't growing too much. Yeah. So that kind of policing of your body is something that we all share, that we all have to overcome, even though it just looks different from the outside. But there's so many similarities. And the reason why I bring that up is because people feel very comfortable criticizing these things when it comes to When it's coming from an evangelical Christian place, but when it's coming from an Islamic place, people are hesitant. And that goes back to the whole Ben Affleck fiasco that got me speaking up in the first place, is that Sam Harris and Bill Maher were saying, regardless of where these atrocities are happening, we have to stand up for liberal values and stand up against these archaic values. And yeah, I think that's just the message that I like to get across more than anything else, is people that are suffering. We talk about people here, we talk about how the church treats, you know, they won't bake a cake. And you know what I mean? Like we talk about how horrible they are with their conversion camps and things like that. And we talk about Westboro Baptist Church. We're comfortable talking about all of these things, but let's also talk about all of these similar atrocities that are happening all over the world, because those people are ignored because of people fearing being called Islamophobic, bigot, racist, blah, blah, blah.
I think what I'm hearing you saying, it's easy to maybe think that these liberal values, you know, as we're generally thinking about them, we just put them in the Western world or the quote unquote developed world, but really these are universal values and apply to all humans on the globe, no matter where they find themselves being born, what religion that they're in. And so if we say that, you know, LGBTQ rights matter, that they matter not only here in the US, but they matter in Libya or Saudi Arabia as well. And
absolutely,
we have to, it sounds like you're saying we have to understand that when we preach this.
Absolutely. That was so beautifully, succinctly, you know, summarized. And I think that there is this fallacy that people are, they're a different culture. They like that. They want that. No, they don't. We're all human beings. We are, you know, when I talk about hijab, for example, people like to say, oh no, Muslim women find it empowering. They like to wear it. Would you like to wear it? Would you find it empowering? You know, she's not subhuman. She's not a different kind of human. She's still a woman. She's still a human being. She's still somebody who wants her bodily autonomy. She's been, in some cases, in all cases, indoctrinated from a young age to believe that she needs to wear this, you know, but, and some people do support their own subjugation and say, yes, you know, I do want to wear this. This is, and I used to do that. I was one of those people. There's no way I would allow anybody to tell me, to feel sorry for me, to pity me that I was wearing hijab. My gosh, no way. I would totally stand up for it and say, I love wearing this. But it's the idea that women in Afghanistan, for example, are okay wearing, you know, these big blue body bags because it's their culture is so atrocious to me. Because you are making an assumption that the human being under that body bag is different than you are. And I think people need to remember that we, at the end of the day, we're all human beings. We all want our freedom. You know, women in Afghanistan are risking their lives to ride a bike, to sing, not just Afghanistan, Iran, Egypt, Algeria. I could go on and on, right? Riding a bike is against the law. Singing is against the law. Laughing too loud in Turkey is against the law. I mean, it just goes on and on. So nobody wants those kinds of controls on their bodies and on their freedom.
The way you describe, I'm sorry, the hijab is the hood that, or the covering on your head. What's the whole outfit called?
Yeah. So technically hijab just means cover. So any of those levels of it are all called hijab, but colloquially we use the word hijab to mean covering everything but the face and hands. And the only reason why we do that is because that's the most popular way that women cover.
You described it as these women are living in body bags.
Yes.
And that struck me just now. And like, if they step out of that body bag, there's a very good chance that they'll be entering another body bag, mm-hmm. just because of the cold. That's I wouldn't want to live like that.
This is not even me. This is propaganda that came from an Islamist group that had it was a big, huge billboard, and it had a woman in a body bag on a stretcher. And it said, you're either going to, you know, whether you want to wear it or not, you're going to end up wearing it. So you might as well wear it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's some 1984 shit. For sure.
Yeah,
it is.
Holy yeah. crap.
Yeah.
Well, and that's just so amazing to me, too, that, I mean, what your organization does then is, you know, it's giving women the opportunity to actually have some agency in their lives and not just, we don't have to hear the imam or whoever saying what they should wear or Sam Harris saying what they should or shouldn't be told to wear. Instead, it makes it possible for people to just actually come out and say, I'm done with this.
Yes, exactly.
That's fantastic. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they're allowed to say, I want to wear it. Everybody mm-hmm. supports that. I mean, yeah. there's like fireworks when you say, I want to wear it. But if you try to say, I don't want to wear it, that's when the trouble happens. And so those are the people that we're trying to support. Yeah. Same thing with believing, you know, if you say, I want to be a believing Muslim, well, of course, everybody is very excited about that. If you mm-hmm. say, well, I have doubts or I don't want to believe in this, well, now you've put your life in danger. So yes, absolutely. Right. It's just about freedom. That's why I have mm-hmm. the word free in there twice, because, you know, it's about freedom, freedom to love who you want, freedom to think however you want, freedom to wear whatever you want. And again, my hashtag is free from hijab. It's about freedom. Just allow people the choice to be able to decide for themselves what they want and what they don't want. And that's all I'm talking about. The word free is a negative word. It's a bad word in the Islamic connotation. So that's another reason why I really embrace it and try to, you know, switch it around and talk about freedom as a positive thing. My gosh, it's like the most positive thing ever.
So so in Muslim majority countries, the foundation's name has some different connotation than it does here in the Western.
Yeah. I mean, it's like war is peace, you know, freedom is slavery. You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing.
Okay.
So it's like they do, you know, the word freedom gets spat out. What do you want to be in a Westerner? You want your freedom, like an American whore. You want your freedom to be in orgies. You know what I mean? That's what freedom is, right? Oh, what kind of freedom are you looking for? You know, you don't think that what Allah has provided is his guidelines aren't good enough for you. You want to be free to, you know, insert whatever crazy thing here, you know, eat babies. I don't know.
It's a slippery slope.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think that there might be people on this call that will relate to that too, of like, just this, you need control all the time. And they think that as soon as they let go a little bit of control, the first thing we're going to do is just find an orgy somewhere.
Yeah. You know,
starting a WhatsApp group.
I think some people will support that in this group here.
Coming up next week, we don't have a show. It's just going to be an orgy. That's all it's going to be. I've been an atheist for like, 12 years now, and I've yet to be a part of an orgy.
Get
so
on that, Eric.
Yeah, don't at me, please. Yasmin, thank you so much for this. We can go into the question and answer session yet, but I kind of want to just give you the last word. I feel like you've said everything that you wanted to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Eric.
Fantastic. Great. Kara, why don't you kick us off with some of the questions?
Absolutely. Yeah. Speaking on, let's see, we've got several good questions actually that people put on here that they put throughout the chat, and feel free to put more in. If y'all have more questions, write them in the chat. But one that we just got that kind of segues nicely is, what do you wish that Westerners would change in the conversation around Islam? I suppose if they are speaking about it.
I wish that they would be more honest in talking about Islam, as honest about talking about Islam as they would about any other religion. So I think because Christianity is the dominant religion in America, so people are comfortable criticizing it because it's like punching up, and they feel mm-hmm. like talking about Muslims or talking about Islam actually is punching down. And the truth is,
I felt myself putting on kid gloves when I have this kind of discussion with folks, like, okay, I'm walking a little bit on the eggshells. So please set me straight.
Yeah. So I just want you to put yourself in the shoes of a Muslim person or an ex-Muslim person who would have had the exact same experience as you. Do you know what I mean? So they grew up in a fundamentalist home. They've escaped it now. And the people that are supposed to be their allies and supporters are nervous to support them, are hesitant to speak up for them. And think about how that would make them feel betrayed. So I've left this community. I'm trying to feel welcome in this new community, but I'm not feeling welcomed. In fact, what you see happening, which is one of the most ultimate betrayals, is you see a celebration or a fetishization of the aspects of that religion that we are fighting. So if I bring it back to hijab, it's on the cover of Sports Illustrated, Nike's put a swoosh on it. It's, you know, the stamp of approval has been put on it from the Western world. Whereas they would never do that with Mormon underwear. You know, Nike would never put a swoosh and endorse.
Oh my God.
Right?
Can we just do that? Oh my God. We have the technology these days. They have the automated stitching machines. That would be amazing. Yeah. And we could charge like 10 times as much.
It's even more than not criticizing it. It's celebrating it. It's fetishizing it. There are women in prison today in Iran for not wearing hijab. And then for them to see that, you know, Mattel makes little tiny hijabs for Barbie. Like, it is really hurtful, especially when we look to the Western world so often as the beacon of freedom. I mean, we're talking about the suffragettes in Saudi Arabia as if it's, you know, it's fresh, because they are the suffragettes, right? That they are still fighting for their most basic freedoms to be regarded as an equal human being to a man. And so when you look up to the West all the time and look up to America, and then to find that fellow atheists in America or fellow free thinkers or fellow liberals are supporting the thing that is getting women imprisoned, that is getting women killed, that is getting women attacked with acid, It's really difficult to swallow that. So when you find yourself hesitant, please think about the people and how much they would appreciate you pushing through the hesitancy.
That's a really great point, you know, about people think that, oh, you know, I'm being nice, I'm supporting, you know, other religions that are a quote unquote minority, but, you know, as you pointed out, are not exactly rare. But also, what about the sexism and the patriarchal mindset that's going into that? It's, you're supporting one thing while contributing to the disenfranchisement of another group within that group that's additionally marginalized. That's really interesting how you put that.
FGM activists have to fight against, you know, do-gooders that say, well, FGM is just cultural. You know, like, these are women that are risking their lives to fight against this draconian, misogynist, disgusting, horrific, traumatizing mutilation of their daughters and sisters. And you have, you know, people over here saying tap, tap on the head, tap, you know, it's just their culture. We have to respect it.
Right. But who wants that happening to them, you know?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's a part of it too. And you hear that all the time. I hear that all the time from the Muslim world. Mm-hmm. They don't care because they know that they're never going to be at risk.
Yeah. It's not their problem. You can pat yourself on the back for being progressive and not have to deal with the harms that are really occurring.
Yeah. Oof. And when you have power, you should feel compelled to help those who are powerless.
Got it.
So, you know, the women in these countries are fighting But they do need the help of people with power to help them, because they're not getting that kind of help and support in their communities. So they need it from progressive nations. And so when you see politicians coming into Iran, putting a hijab on, you know, that's a slap in the face.
Mm-hmm.
When you're thinking these are, oh, somebody from Sweden is coming, like, oh, they're going to have something to say about this. No, they don't. They're totally succumbing and supporting the same patriarchy that you're fighting against.
That's a really interesting way to look at that. That's a great point. Yikes.
Yasmin, we kind of talked about how just the human experience is universal across the world. And one of the questions sort of touches on that, which I think kind of goes to the root of what Free Hearts Remind is all about. How do you cope with the fear of being found?
Wow. Yeah. A lot of distraction. My husband carries that fear. You know, he has covered the house in a security system. He has like a P.O. box in a different city for Free Hearts, Free Minds. Like, he's very nervous about it. And I let him, I sort of try not to think about it, because if I did, I would stop, and I don't want to stop. And so, I just trust that I'm doing everything I can to keep myself and my family safe. And I really, really strongly feel that if people are silenced over there, and if we silence ourselves over here, then there will be no one left to talk. And so I feel compelled to keep going. In fact, the more threats I get, the more that anger, you know, feeds my desire to keep talking.
So from what I'm hearing, even though you're decades away from the second husband and leaving, you're still not living a normal life. You're still, there's still a risk.
Yes, because I'm speaking out. So in Islam, like if I had denounced Islam and stayed quiet, I wouldn't be putting myself in danger. But because I've denounced Islam and I'm supporting others who denounce Islam, that makes me an enemy.
I can see that. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a kind of a follow-up question that somebody had here that comes up nicely next. How often do you have to deal with harassment about this, either directly or directed to your organization, from people who are practicing Muslims? Or
daily, multiple times per day. Yeah.
Wow.
It's a constant onslaught. It's it comes in waves. So there's like the normal, you know, I'm going to find you, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to do this to you, I'm going to blah, blah, blah. But every now and then they will kick it up a notch. You know, they'll like start to mention my children, or let me know that they have private information about me, stuff like that. If I'm ever going for a talk, then it totally, you know, I've had a nice quiet year with COVID, because usually whenever I'm going for a talk, it ramps up so much. But of course, with Zoom, it's different. But yeah, because now they know where I'm going to be and when I'm going to be there. And so that's all very, it's more than anything, they're trying to fuck with me. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So
yes.
Yeah. So if I just, most of these messages are coming from like Pakistan and Bangladesh. Like, what are you going to do? Hop on a plane and come to Canada, you know?
Right.
Sometimes I get them from like Australia or more Western countries and stuff like that. But most of the time it's coming from, at least according to their profiles and stuff, it's coming from somewhere in the Arab or Muslim majority world. And so it's just scare tactics, like somebody said on the message there. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like it's the grown up version of the, I can just bury you in the backyard, and we're just
yeah,
kind of continuing yeah. with that same threat.
Yeah. I will just mention really briefly, I know I've been, every question you ask, I go on a long tirade, but this is just really quickly, I'm going to tell you guys about a woman named Dina Tokyo, who is a modesty model. So she's a hijabi model, or she was a hijabi model. And she was like in music videos and cover of magazines and whatever. So she did this for years. And then she decided to take off her hijab. She lives in the United Kingdom. Her family is from Egypt, but she lives in the United Kingdom. And when she decided to take off her hijab, she was inundated with so many threats and so much hate that she has a YouTube video where she just sits there with her phone and does nothing but read the messages. The video is over an hour long, and then she stops. She's like, okay, you know, this, I think you've heard enough. Yeah. So that's just so to give, she had the strength of stomach to read each one of these messages and to let you see the kinds of messages that we receive for taking, for choosing what to do with her own body. She's still a Muslim. She's not even at my level, you know, like she's not getting the hate that I get because she's still a Muslim, but she's just decided that she doesn't want to put a piece of cloth on her own head. And this is what she has to deal with.
Mm-hmm. We have a comment in the chat here that's
her name is, this is Dina Tokyo. Yes. Thank you, Sumaya. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. I'm going to look that up.
Yeah, that this is proof positive that a hijab is never a choice
at all. Absolutely. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
I think we got time for one more question. And I kind of want to go back to the coping with the fear of being found. I know that you've corresponded with so many of the folks who have come to Free Hearts, Free Minds for help. Do you feel, or do you have a sense of how the individuals in the Muslim majority countries cope with that fear of being found out? Is it similar to you, or is it heightened? Is it different?
It's way worse, way, way more heightened. So the way I had a man from Egypt explain it to me was, he said, Yasmin, you're afraid that a man with a gun might find you, whereas I feel the barrel of the gun on my neck. I feel the pressure of it. I feel the cold steel on my neck. And I was like, oh my God, you're so right. Like I know that. I know that. And I know that he's absolutely correct. So yeah, it's there's no comparison, which is why I feel compelled to speak up, because I know that I'm in a much safer space. It's dangerous for everybody. It's dangerous for anybody. If any of you after this decide to post something, you're going to get hate. And the hate may not only come from the Muslim community, it can come from your friends, it can come from your family as well. It could come from coworkers, you could be putting your job at risk, you know? So there's always that risk, but it's a spectrum. So we still are in a much better position than so many others. And so it's all about personal choice, you know, how much risk are you willing to, you know, how much are you willing to risk for speaking the truth?
I said we had what time for one more question, but I lied. The chat has brought up an excellent question that I think was actually in the poll. What is the most important thing we can do to help support ex-Muslims in either here or mostly in Muslim majority countries?
Well, I would say first and foremost, be honest in your conversations. So when the discussions do come up and you get a thought in your head and you sort of want to censor yourself, please be more, be more willing to share your actual thoughts and feelings and perspectives, because I think the more we silence ourselves, the more we self-censor ourselves, the more it allows victims to continue being victimized. It gives cover to the perpetrators. And so we need to speak up against these things as loudly as we would speak up against them if they were happening to any other group of people. Oh. Yeah.
So take the fucking kid gloves off is what you're saying.
Yeah, please do. I mean, I say that carefully because I know that it comes with risks, but please just start the conversations. You know, I get most of my emails that I get are from people ranting because they're like, you know what my sister said at dinner today? And then they want to get it out, but they can't say it at the dinner table. So they'll send me the message. I mean, I got one from a guy yesterday that was arguing with his daughter, and he's like, he couldn't get his daughter to understand. So he's like ranting to me. So even the family dynamics, it can be like a father to a daughter. It doesn't matter. People feel like they are the bad person when they start to talk about the inequalities and the atrocities that are happening under Islam. But we need to flip that script. You know, people need to start recognizing that, you know, the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, people are very comfortable talking about the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan and how vicious they are to women because they can blame America for that. But if you start to, you know, scratch the surface a little bit, what other country, like the Islamic Republic of Iran, you know, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, Saudi Arabia, the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, like all of these countries, women are treated viciously, atrociously in all of these countries. But because we can't blame America, because we can't blame Biden, people don't want to talk about it. So they're still not talking about the source of the problem. They're still wanting to either point to a white man or a Jewish man. Those are the only two people that we can point to and criticize. Anybody else, people feel like, oh, I'll be the bad guy if I talk about that. But you got to flip it around and realize, no, you're being the good guy because you're the one who is speaking up for all of those people in all of those countries who are being victimized. And the people that are, you know, wanting to silence you have an agenda for that. And people are starting to see that now. The UK Sharia Council just released a statement saying we need to give the Taliban a chance. Well, of course, the UK Sharia Council would say that. I wonder why. Exactly. So, you know, this is a huge, I mean, the Organization of Islamic Cooperative is the largest intergovernment organization. You know, it's second to only to the UN. So this is a massive, huge machine that we're speaking up against here. And so we need everybody's voice. We need everybody to be everybody who's thinking and feeling that they want to speak up in support of people that are fighting in those countries, then just please, please do so.
Yasmin, thank you so, so much for being with us here tonight. This was an eye-opening discussion. And even though we did have the Islam session almost a year ago, I still learned so much. And it was a great reminder that to get out of my Western-minded thinking and look over the globe at those people suffering and struggling in the Muslim-majority countries. Thank you so much for bringing that to the forefront of my mind again.
My absolute pleasure.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, Healing, and Support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.
You know what it's like to journey out of a once cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days, and now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help, and Recovering from Religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language. Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering from Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the Volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.